Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Inflation and a stagnant economy. That's stagflation, and it looks like we're heading to both of those in many parts of the world, almost certainly in the UK, perhaps in America as well. So what do we do about it? As we'll hear this time, it's different. So can you apply the same cure? Does the cure work anyway? I mean, central banks seem to think that pushing up interest rates will fix the inflation part of the equation, and maybe supply chains will fix themselves, and that's going to help too. But does lower inflation and supplies returning to normal, does that mean that the economy will start growing again? We are certainly in uncertain times. So what next? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Well, if you take May the 5th as the benchmark, that is when there were the most Google searches for the term stagflation. So if you set that as an index of 100 and you go back to February, the index on stagflation searches then was around 7 to 10. So that's how quickly this stagflation fear has gone from 10 to 100 in just a couple of months. So we weren't even thinking about it at the end of last year. But there is now, that Steve, this growing assumption that the world is heading for a recession, and there's nothing central banks can do to stop it, even though they perhaps think they can. In fact, arguably, you could say, you know, they're helping bring it forward because they're pushing up interest rates. So recession with inflation, is what stagnation is. How do we what is the definition? Do you think we're a load of questions for you? So I'm just going to go off and have a coffee. I'm going to load you up with the questions, Steve. So do you think, what is that the definition of stagflation? Do you think we're going to get it, and how do we fight it?
Let's go back in history, because the first period of so-called stagflation is what led to the state of economics today, because the fact that you had rising prices and rising unemployment, that's fundamentally the definition of stagflation that came in the early 70s. And according to the conventional interpretation of Keynesian economics, that wasn't possible, because what you had in economic management was a belief in what was called the Phillips curve. And this was the result of research by a New Zealand engineer turned economist, Bill Phillips, who was one of the brightest and best humans have ever existed. I emphasize that, who was an engineer who wanted to bring engineering concepts across to economics. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Okay. So he was bringing the whole idea of dynamic systems, feedback loops, all the stuff that I built in my Minsky software, he was doing back in the 50s, and he was literally doing it by making a water-based computer, and he made an analog computer before he actually had digital. He made an analog computer that was capable of modeling the economy using capacitors and resistors and so on for changing electric levels and all this sort of jazz. Now, as part of his model, he presumed that there'd be rising what he called factor prices during periods of high economic activity, and that's pretty much what we were talking about on the last podcast. When you had a booming economy, then there would be a possibility of high prices for oil, okay, out of the boom, and also with low unemployment, high price for labor. So he literally hand drew this idea of a non-linear relationship. Below a certain level of economic activity, prices would be fairly constant. This is prices for labor and capital, and for labor and raw material inputs. And then when you got a boom, those prices would go up quite sharply. And so he then went to check the data to see if he could verify this using English data on unemployment and the rate of change of money wages. So it wasn't the rate of inflation, it was the rate of change of money wages that he correlated with the level of unemployment. And he actually had to go back and assemble data from trade unions, because he went back to 1861 or 1863 through to 1917 was his first data set. And back in those days, the government did not record how many people were unemployed, but the trade unions knew how many of the members were out of work. Because you're out of work, you didn't have to pay pay union dues, so they kept the records that way.
Right.
So he assembled all this data on the unemployment level of unemployment, and then he correlated to the rate of change of money wages, and that data was collected, again, fairly haphazardly. He had to put a few price series together. And what he got was exactly the sort of thing he expected to get of a very nonlinear relationship between the level of unemployment and the rate of change of money wages. And this was all to explain to put numbers on an element he'd literally drawn of in a circuit diagram of a feedback effect that would change the rate of inflation, largely given by the rate of unemployment. This is why I get so annoyed when I see neoclassical economists saying things like the Phillips curve is dead, blah, blah, blah. In his paper, where he put those statistical numbers together, he said there were three factors that determined the rate of change of money wages. One was the rate level of unemployment. Two was the rate of change of unemployment. So he said if you had unemployment rising, then that would temper wage demands, even though the level of unemployment might be quite high. A level of unemployment might be quite low. If it's rising, that will temper wage demands. So you had a first-order effect, the level of unemployment, a second-order effect, the rate of change of unemployment, and the third factor is what he described in terms of import prices rising, and that's pretty much where your oil and coal comes in, because he said that there would be cost-of-living adjustments.
Yeah.
And that would cause, and he literally, I think he has in his version, a wage-price spiral. Now, this is exactly what we spoke about later as what caused the so-called demise of the Phillips curve, but it was nowhere near as simplistic as the garbage that neoclassical economists.
But isn't that exactly where we are now? So there's also the supply chain difficulties as well. But I mean, part of it is. But a chunk of it as well is the fact that people are asking for higher wages because there are so many jobs for whatever reason, the Great Resignation. You know, labor markets are very tight.
And when you look back historically, this period, because the mistake that Phillips did make. It was a throwaway line in the middle of his paper where he said that it looks like there's a trade-off between unemployment and the rate of inflation. If you want to have a low rate of unemployment, you have to have a high rate of inflation and vice versa. And it made it like a menu, and he actually gave a couple of the choices. If you wanted stable consumer prices, you needed a 5.5% rate of unemployment in the UK. If you wanted stable factor prices, you wanted a 7.5% rate of unemployment. Something of that nature.
So central banks heard that and read that and then said, well, okay, well that's easy then. We'll just, if we want to get inflation down, we'll just destroy jobs,
and effectively it made it look like there was a simple trade-off. Choose one number, you get the other. Okay. And then the crazy thing is when Phillips did that data from 1863 to 1917, I think it was, he then used to derive the curve that he used, he was using a handheld calculator. Actually, he had to borrow a calculator from, I think it was UCL, I'm not sure, borrow a calculator from the university he was at, he was the head of school, take it over on the weekend and crunch the numbers by hand. And of course, he had about 60 data points, and that was just too damn hard back in the 50s with the manual calculator. So he summarized it down to 7 data ranges, and out of the 7, he got an average for the unemployment rate, an average for the rate of money change of money wages, and then fitted a logarithmic curve to that. And then when he'd used that curve to data later from 1917 through to, I think, 1956, then the data, with a couple of obvious exceptions which were easily explained, fitted that 1861 to 1917 data like a glove. And when it came up, he'll said, great, here's this simple, all the economic management, all we need to do is worry about these two variables and choose the numbers we want. Now, that was and Phillips, when he saw this happening, said that if he knew how his research would use, he would never have done it. So this is the sort of intellectual corruption that lies at the heart of modern economic management.
Well, it's not too complicated to understand what's happening right now, though, is it? We've got supply chain difficulties which are pushing up the prices of goods, including the price of energy, which has got the knock-on effect. And one of those knock-on effects is well, because we've got a tight labour market, is that people are able to choose where they work, plus so they're asking for higher wages, plus they have to ask for higher wages because everything's going up in price, and so it goes on. So does that create stagflation though?
It's again more complicated than there's very fundamental differences between what happened in the 70s and what's happening now. But the symptoms can look the same.
Well, the unemployment level is very different for fundamental.
Right. Unemployment was stagflation, but unemployment was rising.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, so when we're saying stagflation now, where's the stag coming from and all that? It's the supply chain hassles.
Yeah.
The breakdown of the supply chain. And that's only going to get worse. COVID, I think, is going to be for us. We've stuffed up COVID completely. It's going to be an endemic pandemic from now on, and that will forever be hitting people's capacity to work. So there'll be insufficient labor caused by a breakdown of the supply system, the whole length of the supply chain, which is one reason why inflation fell so much, because we're exploiting low wages and low environmental standards in the third world for so long. That itself was breaking down anyway, because now China's got, which is the biggest sure source by far, has had quite a comfortable standard of living for most people. So the cheap wage side of that is gone, but the long supply chain still exists. Well, that's being broken down. We've got Shanghai being shut down by COVID right now. So all these things, and Beijing as well coming through. So all this stuff is brand new. It looks the same, but it's very different. And what's left out of it all, of course, is the role of finance. So when you look back and say what caused the stagflation in the 70s, Milton Friedman's argument was that it's because of changing expectations. And that's why you got all this, pardon me, I've got to use a technical term, all this shit coming out of central banks about managing inflationary expectations. Because in Milton Friedman's theory, what caused prices to rise was expectations that prices were going to rise. And so you had to get expectations right. You'll see the word expectations. It's almost used as frequently as the word the in papers by central bankers.
Well, we can ignore him this time, can't we, completely? Thank goodness.
He's getting reborn, and that's the trouble. He's a zombie.
But none of this was expected. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't any expectation. People now are demanding higher wages because prices are going up. You know, it's no expectation of prices going up. Prices
are
going
up.
There's not, this lag effect. Yeah. They're actually asking for more money because they need it to try and stay alive, to try and stay afloat.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they've got some bargaining power because, the employers, even though they haven't got enough workers to produce what they need to produce, because some of them are on sick leave, they need others to come in and take their place. So it is a bizarre new situation. It's having some of the similar appearances to the 70s, but it's got a very different set of causes.
Really call it stagflation because it's not the same as stagflation as it was.
What's going to happen historically is that people will label them the same way. Okay. Mm. And then what you'll get is two very different experiences will be given the same sets of causes, and probably the same explanation coming from Milton Friedman will be used for both. But Milton got the first one wrong, and he'd get this one wrong as well, because what actually caused the collapse, the rising unemployment that went, the rising prices in the 70s, can be related to the burst of the first major private debt bubble, because you had a huge private debt bubble giving huge credit base demand. And largely driven through, as usual, as Richard Vague points out all the time, housing bubbles in the West, quite widespread housing bubbles. That then crashed, the credit-based demand plunged, and that meant rising unemployment. But at the same time, it had this period of high demand leading up to it, again, credit-financed, leading to high wages and then a flow-through of high oil prices. And part of that was also driven by the Yom Kippur War, when the OPEC decided to flex its muscles and refused to supply countries that had supported Israel. So the oil price went from $2.50 to $10 a barrel, courtesy of the embargo. Now, there's a similarity in the sense that now we've got an insufficient supply of oil, but that's coming out of the supply chain breakdown, not out of political action by OPEC. We had collapsing investment demand with a momentum in the price system, gave us what happened back in the 70s. And now what we've got is a collapse in the production system. There's not much investment going on. It's not debt financed as much as it was back in the 70s.
Yeah, well, we've got, this is one of your feedback loops to go into your model, Steve. We've got the situation where oil companies are now saying, well, actually, we can't extract enough oil because we haven't got enough workers and enough investment, because there's rising prices of labor is making it too expensive for us to extract some of this oil. So actually, they're extracting less oil. And of course, they would extract less oil because the less oil they extract, the higher the price they can sell for the stuff that they are getting. So, so of course, you know, they extract less because it's the labor costs are too high to extract more. That pushes oil prices up. You get inflation. People ask for higher wages because prices are going up. That's a feedback loop.
Yep. And again, we're navigating through it, but according to economists, as if the economy is in equilibrium. You know, I mean, this is surely this is one of the times to start laughing at the whole idea of modelling capitalism as it's in equilibrium. Nobody's on their feet at the moment. We're all getting our knees knocked by shocks from left, right, and bloody centre. And you're not going to be anywhere near that equilibrium point. So they're trying to analyse it that way with their inflationary expectations, et cetera, et cetera. That's what central banks are doing, are putting up interest rates. But when you look at what actually caused the inflation to stop in the 70s, it was Vogler's interest rate rises. And rather than that having the effect that Milton said, which would you be able to adjust their expectations downwards and there'd be a gentle decline or a bit of a rise in unemployment and then a fall in prices, inflation and so on and so forth back down to the equilibrium situation.
It was the early 80s, wasn't it? In fact, when Volcker sort of pushed America into recession.
It was the biggest recession since the Great Depression.
People are talking about that now as though it was a great thing. You know, 15%, the inflation was almost 15%, so he pushed interest rates up to, actually got up to 21.5%, decimated the construction sector, farming in America, industry generally. There was the recession. But people look and say, yeah, but after we had that, things returned to normal. Demand came back, interest rates were lowered, so they're saying, well, job done. Well done, Volcker. We might need to do that again. We might need to feel the hurt of a recession. But if we did that, would we come out of it like we did then?
Not now, because what we're doing is also unwinding the whole low-cost structure that applied during the period of expanding globalization. So if you go back to the 70s when Volcker was, doing it, you literally had the very, very first major free trade zones being built in the third world. There were plenty beforehand. They started in the 70s, but they were done in such a fashion that the companies would, as wage rises rose in one country relative to another, they'd simply up and pull their capital equipment and move to the other company and country. And you didn't have a sustained impact of industrialization in the third world to provide a supply chain across to the West. But what the Chinese did, and I went to ground zero of this in 1981, in November, December 81. I met the people who established the Shenzhen Free Trade Zone just outside Hong Kong. And their concept, this is with a group of Australian journalists that I took on a tour over there to meet Chinese journalists. And the way that the trade zone was set up was that to actually establish a company in the free trade zone and take advantage of incredibly low wages. You'd pay a Chinese worker as much for a month at that stage, roughly speaking, as you'd pay an American worker for a day. So there was a huge cost advantage to the companies that took advantage of this.
But those days are gone.
Well, no, there's that. They had to have a Chinese partner, and the Chinese partner had to own 50% of the business within 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay, just on the bottom line.
But
But what has happened is that meant China built this long-term supply chain.
Yeah.
So rather than flicking around, you know, just exploiting cheap wages here or there, you've got this really highly structured, very low-cost production system.
Which we are pulling apart now.
And therefore the cost of production have to rise.
Yeah, but they only have to rise to a point, don't they? So we've gone high inflation because we are going through this transition to this, to this new world, which could be a good thing, couldn't it? I mean, if prices go up, but then they stop going up. So inflation is high because it's just a point in time. Couldn't they settle back down again because we get to these new higher levels of production costs? Everything costs more. Maybe wages haven't kept pace with that because they just can't. So we don't get that upward wage spiral. We'd get to a position where it might actually be a good thing that we actually say, well, okay, we can't afford to consume as much. We are chewing up less of the planet's resources because higher prices means we're buying less. I mean, it could be a good thing, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, it could be.
That's my come by our moment. We always have a come by our moment on this podcast. That's my come by our moment this week.
I'm being the Grinch today because we have we're trying to sustain a massive level of overconsumption of the planet's resources, and we therefore, you're not going to work. If we continue doing it, then the climate will destroy our productive capabilities as it changes too radically for our sedentary civilization to maintain itself. You know, we'll get wheat fields washed away and then burnt dry, and then where you want to move to doesn't have the topsoil you need to have to produce the alternative, so you'll have a plunge in output that way, and that therefore means lower living standards. And the question is, can you sustain Western societies if you have a plunge in the living standards of the poor? And to some extent, what we saw in the Arab Spring, I think answers that in the negative. If you start applying it in the West, so it's not going to be a good thing, because
you've got to look after the answers. You've got to look after the poor, haven't you? So I mean, the big problem is that, you know, if we rely on central banks to try and fix everything, it really is a sledgehammer approach.
They're putting up the interest rate, and that's all they've got. And then this is where I said the economic theory.
Surely a fiscal approach is a better way. You know, we need to tax the rich so they stop buying yachts. You know, we could tax the living daylights out of them. But those people on low income who are struggling through recession, as we were talking about last week, you know, who can't afford to keep their house, pay their fuel bills, you know, we should make sure that they are getting the support they need. So it's, you know, so the when they tried, you know, the problems that they saw in Paris, people were protesting because there was an attempt to try and change our behavior when it came to, consumption, and it was hitting the poor. So we just need to make sure it doesn't hit the poor, it hits the rich. And that has to be can only be done through taxation, surely.
Or the idea of, I've been developing with Adam Hardy, of a universal carbon credit. Is it a parallel pricing system? That is one way to cope with it. But overall, the cost of production was driven too low by globalization and by too cheap energy. And now we've got a breakdown of both of those happening at much the same time. So the cost structure has to rise, and that's not something that interest rates can control. And this is where, again, economists have led us up a garden path, or over a desert path closer to it. And that is that they, in their theories, which developed after Milton Friedman, you know, jumped in and tried to assassinate Keynes by assassinating Phillips, they built their models, their dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, presume that the inflation rate is set by inflationary expectations, and the interest rate is what we all use. We all sit down and calculate, decide what to consume based on the interest rate. I've forgotten the term. They've got the Euler equation, I think, insulting another great mathematician. But the idea is they have our consumption is based on us planning the an infinite consumption pattern. Now we sit down and we plan for the infinite future. Because we're rational, and the rational means you know the future, and you can predict it, and you plan for the infinity. I'm not joking. These guys, I mean, as I ever say, you know, Amsterdam was fun, but they didn't give drugs out that good in Amsterdam. But this is the nonsense they come up with.
Well, so, they've got that crazy idea, haven't they? That if interest rates are low, then we are going to consume more because we've got more money because we're paying less on our mortgages. That's the part of the argument. Ignoring the fact that their mortgages are higher because the house prices are so much higher because the interest rates are low.
Yeah, but they're just completely ignoring the impact on asset markets. What they're saying is that varying the interest rate varies our desired consumption over the infinite future. And therefore, when you change the interest rate, you're affecting people's consumption decisions. And they then assume that the supply will come no matter what. And you'll have less demand, so you'll get lower rate of inflation. And therefore, what they've got is a model which is completely wrong and completely useless in the current situation. So they put up interest rates that will crush demand, not in the way they're thinking at all. It just means people won't be able to spend as much for goods and services, if they're paying more money on their financial costs, which don't turn up in consumption, by the way, and the way consumption is measured. So that'll cause a plunge in demand. But at the same time, the suppliers will have no choice but to put their prices up because their carrying costs will be higher. So if you've got not only is the supply chain broken down, you're paying demurrage costs on the goods which you can't get out of the shipping yards fast enough, and you can't get from China fast enough, and consequently your prices rise. So we're going to get rising interest rates and rising inflation, and that's going to be the stagflation for the neoclassicals.
But do we need stuff to drive the economy? So if we look at, and I'm sure this is the same around the world, UK's domestic material consumption, which is the total amount of materials that are directly used by the economy. So this is calculated as domestic extraction of minerals plus imports minus exports. That's gone from 739 million metric tons in 2000 down to 569 million metric tons in 2018. So we are, even though the economy is growing, we are consuming less materials. Because, and now this is, of course, this is based on, you know, weight and a lot of materials like, you know, the minerals we use for mobile phones don't weigh very much. So I'm sure that has some sort of influence on this. But we also have a growing service sector. So that is less material based. You know, the we spend money in cafes and, you know, rather than buying stuff. So isn't there a potential where stuff is more expensive? Goods just are more expensive. And, you know, we go through a transition period because supply chains are shorter but more expensive, and we just value what we get that little bit more. But actually, our lifestyle is more, you know, driven by the service sector. So there's less need for consumption.
That's the whole idea that we're decoupling. You know, that GDP is decoupling from energy consumption. And, like, it can be true in some parts of the world, but it's untrue in others. If you're getting an improving living standard in Thailand, you go out and buy an air conditioner, okay? You don't go and buy a subscription to Netflix. So at the individual level, yes, you can find those effects, and they'll be more prominent in the advanced countries than they are in the third world. But there's so much of the world that aspires to the living standard the West has that more than counteracts the other side. So when I do my correlations of the change in energy and change in GDP, I get a correlation coefficient up in the 0.8 range for the two, and pretty much it's one for one. So a change in GDP is a change in energy, and one can drive the other. Obviously, you can have experiences like the 70s oil boom, when the decline in energy caused a decline in GDP. You can have others where the 2008 crisis, where the decline in GDP caused a decline in energy consumption. But fundamentally, they're Siamese twins, and the whole idea that they're separating, is based on looking at just one tiny part of a global system.
But you're saying that's in developing nations. Are you accepting that in developed nations, it's
happening, but nowhere near as fast as people think. And if we see, we're going to have Madge and Midge and Marge in the last podcast, if you find prices rising so much that people, simply can't afford energy, then it's their material consumption of other things that's going to go down. If the prices drop, their material consumption will go up.
But it's the throwaway culture's part of this, isn't it? And if things became so expensive it were made better, so we didn't have that throwaway culture, I mean, that would be a step forward. And that's where you get into, the alternative that maybe you don't buy stuff, you rent stuff. So you don't buy a car, you rent a car, and the car company then goes, right, well, now we're renting this, we want it to last as long as possible. We really want to sweat the asset that we've created here, so we're going to make a car that lasts for a long time.
And you're also going to have car sharing and, that sort of thing is feasible, true. It's still, like, if we want to go, for example, from a totally fossil fuel-based economy to a totally minerals-based, electric cars and photovoltaic cells and so on, that's an enormous demand for physical material. I think the UK might have something like, 50 million cars, half a million of which are electric.
But I mean, we've talked about that in the past, and that is definitely an issue when we're looking at, energy consumption. But, I gave the point where we in the UK we have reduced the amount of material consumption, and we can do the same with energy consumption as well. If we're just satisfied with less, which gets back, back to that, do we look at subscription type models? Do we look at more service orientation than consuming stuff? It's just getting over consuming, and we don't charge to chuck stuff away, so we could base the economy on that as well. I think the point I'm trying to make in all of this is if we are seeing the inflation, the price of things going up, will we reach a point where we just reach a new level? And could we benefit from this? And we reach a new level where everything is more expensive, which means we consume less of it. And the ultimate winner out of all of that is obviously the planet. Are we, you know, could we be going through that right now? Could this be the start of it?
I think it is the start of it. So I look on that front, yeah, I agree. But the trouble is, I don't think it's going to be done in a peaceful fashion. And, you know,
you always ruin it, Steve. Always ruin it. You always ruin it. Here Sorry, we are. We're having a combine moment, and now you're starting World War III.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's a possibility in terms of resource availability and resource wars. And it also, you can't have another gilets jaunes event driven by imposing these costs on the poor. So the level of inequality we've got has to be reversed. And that's going to be a very big ask for Western societies, which have let inequality explode in the last 40 years, to say we've got to control it or we break down.
And what central banks are doing right now, is it are they making the situation worse, or is it just irrelevant? I mean,
I think they're making it worse because, as I said, we're likely to get rising interest rates and rising inflation at the moment because when you've got a long supply chain, which has to be financed, you're paying demurrage costs and, you know, the other elements of the financial side of international transfers of goods, then those are going to be rising and they'll be passed on to the consumer. So just like the 1970s was seen as the breakdown of the Phillips curve, and wrongly so, because it came back after Vockler's crushed the negative relationship between unemployment and the rate of inflation, came back in spades after Vockler crushed the economy back in 81, 82. This time around, we're likely to see rising interest rates and rising inflation, and that's hopefully going to consign the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models that dominate central banks to the garbage bin of history, which is where they should have stayed.
Yeah. Well, no, they'll always find an excuse, won't they, that this time it's...
Yeah, they will.
This time it's different, they will say. But what would be the effect of rising... if interest rates rise... I mean, that I guess that does theoretically destroy demand, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is the same as inflation.
It does.
So
we've
got a double whammy of, but more to the point.
Demand while prices rise.
Right. But I mean, but prices are going to destroy demand as well. Surely, actually, the impact of rising interest rates is going to be more the finance sector and people with big houses are going to feel it the most.
Yeah, and that's feasible. The mortgage belt, people have bought into rising asset prices are going to find those assets are much harder to sustain. So it will be potentially the aspirational classes rather than the renters who cop it. And that's about time.
and we're seeing share prices. You know, starting to tank as well because
it's a fun time in finance markets right now.
So do we care? Is this my question? That side of it, we care about Marge having difficulty because prices of everything is going up, and her pension's not going up by the same amount. But do we really care about those people who've got share portfolios that are losing value?
No, I think we're going to be forced to care because they're the ones who control currently in control of the mechanics of the economy. So their protests are going to be heard in Whitehall far more than the protests of Madge and Midge and Marge. Ultimately, the reversal of inequality has to involve a decline in the consumption levels of the rich, and it can't involve much of a decline in the consumption levels of the poor.
Well, I tell you, if you are looking at what to take out, I mean, it would be pretty hard, wouldn't it, after this year, to look back and not think that actually the income imbalance is something that has to be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
because it's become so extreme.
We've put it off too far, and now it's all happening in the middle of a climate breakdown as well. So, yeah, we've set ourselves up for a wonderful set of problems which central banks are unable to solve. And as you said earlier, it's going to be fiscal policy that comes back, which should never have gone away in the first place.
Which means that, government's getting into debt, central banks buying bonds. Welcome back QE.
Not so much QE, but welcome back deficits, which then enable Madge and Midge and Marge to buy their energy consumptions and their basic commodities.
Easy to solve, Steve. We could do that in a weekend. All right, with a calculator.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll catch you again very soon. Thank you.
Welcome, mate. Okay.
Actually, even from conventional economists, I'm hearing more and more people saying, well, the answer to all of this is a fiscal solution. The government has got to spend to help the poor get through this crisis. That's it for today. Back again with another Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen next week. I'm Phil Dobby. Thanks for your time this morning. We'll catch you again soon.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.